This morning's reading is Genesis chapter 5, from verse 1. This is the written account of Adam's line. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years, and then he died. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. And after he became the father of Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Seth lived 912 years, and then he died. When Enosh had lived 90 years, he became the father of Kenan. And after he became the father of Kenan, Enosh lived 815 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enosh lived 905 years, and then he died. When Kenan had lived 70 years, he became the father of Mahalalel. And after he became the father of Mahalalel, Kenan lived 840 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Kenan lived 910 years, and then he died. When Mahalalel had lived 65 years, he became the father of Jared. And after he became the father of Jared, Mahalalel lived 830 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Mahalalel lived 895 years, and then he died. When Jared had lived 162 years, he became the father of Enoch. And after he became the father of Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Jared lived 962 years, and then he died. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And after he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived 365 years. Enoch walked with God. Then he was no more, because God took him away. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. And after he became the father of Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Methuselah lived 969 years, and then he died. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he had a son. He named him Noah and said, "He will comfort us in the labour and painful toil of our hands, caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." After Noah was born, Lamech lived 595 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Lamech lived 777 years and then he died. After Noah was 500 years old, he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, "I will wipe mankind, whom I have created, from the face of the earth, men and animals, and creatures that move along the ground, and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord.
All right. Good morning again, everyone. There is a famous, possibly one of the most famous circus families ever, called the Great Willenders, or the Flying Willenders. Anyone, any massive circus fans out there? Like, yeah, I know all about them. No. Okay. So I found out about them this week. This is one of their signature tricks, okay? This is them tightrope walking. In a case you can't tell, so these guys are on the bottom row, okay? And then they've got poles between them that these two guys are standing on, and then this chick sitting on a chair on a pole as well. Okay? So these guys have been doing this since the late 1700s, okay? And they've passed on their circus tradition, doing their death-defying acts for seven generations, and these guys are still doing these tricks, alright? It's incredible, like a couple of centuries worth of families doing death-defying feats, except for when they die. So accidents happen. This one, I'm not showing you a picture of somebody dying. This was an accident that happened in 2017 where they fell off during practice, which they do without nets, apparently because it gives them a false sense of security. It's great. Anyway, four of them fell, okay? One of them ended up being in an induced coma and she had to have like 73 screws in her face. That's not an exaggeration. So accident, but this is the crazy thing. This is one of the better accidents. Because in 1978, the grandfather of the current sort of family leaders, Carl Wallander, he died attempting to cross, from one 10-story building to another 10-story building in San Juan in Puerto Rico. He died in 1978 at the age of 73. Okay, so I don't want to hear any excuses from some of you guys out there, alright? You guys can, alright? His uncles both died in 1962, doing tightrope walks, and his auntie also died in 1963, attempting a 45-foot sort of climb and fell and bad. So, these guys are doing all these death-defying feats. Apparently, you know, for centuries, family traits, passing it on, staring death in the face, except for the fact that death keeps coming for them in one way or another. And it kind of reminds me about these early chapters of Genesis, where you have this family line that seems to be defying death, living for centuries and centuries, and yet at the same time we see that death comes for them again and again and again. But not for every one of them. And there's a slim, narrow bit of hope that we're going to look at today and think about for ourselves. So the passage begins with this line, that this is the written account of Adam's line that we trace down to Noah by the end of it. And it says, when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. This is one of the most important verses in all of the Bible for understanding who we are, because it affirms something really, really, really important. All right? It says that Adam, it says again that Adam was made in the image of God. We see this in Genesis 1 and 2. It says that God made people male and female in the image of God. And then it says that Seth is made in the image of Adam. So if Adam is made in the image of God and Seth is made in the image of Adam, who else is Seth also made in the image of? God, right? And this is really important because what that means is that just because sin and death and destruction have come into the world, it hasn't removed the fact that we're made in God's image. Now, tragically, because of sin, we can no longer fulfill that theoretical potential that we have to be God's image in this world, to reflect Him well in His glory, and to represent Him in this world. That's not something that we can fulfill, but that calling, that sense of what we were built for and purposed for, well, that remains. And there's also a sense in the very fact that we see Adam have a child and we're going to see his children have children, that one ability at least that came along with being human remains, and that is that God told people to go forth and multiply, right? And so we see here that despite the fact that sin and death have entered the world and changed things in all sorts of ways, the fundamental basics of what people were called to do and the mission that God gave them remains. That they are meant to be reflecting God's glory, and they go forth and do fill the earth and begin to multiply. Except that we see, don't we, that as this goes along, that everywhere that this multiplication goes, death goes too. So it says in verse 4, after Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years and then he died. And this sets up this pattern that we see all through the chapter where X is born, X lives a certain number of years before they have so-and-so, and then X lives more years and we have a total lifespan for them. And then we see the same pattern repeated with Enosh, with Kenan, with Mahalalel, with Yared, down to Methuselah and Lamech, right? All these guys, same deal as far as what's described. And it's conveying to us this basic idea that humans were designed to live for a very long time. Humans weren't designed originally to die. And we see this sense that the God's ability to create them initially left them the ability to live very, very long lives, but that now death is coming for all of them. Now, it's worth pointing out, it does jump out at us immediately, these really, really long lifespans. And some commentators have looked at this and they're like, is this meant to be taken literally? Are people actually living 4 centuries? They think, could it be symbolic? And they kind of play around with the numbers trying to figure out, is this meant to actually be communicating something else? There's other myths from the ancient Near Eastern times where they have very long lives for their early kings and that sort of stuff. But to me, the text just doesn't go there. In fact, we see in chapter 6, verse 3, a very definitive point where God says, things have been like this, but now they're going to be like this with regards to age and lifespan. That sort of stuff. So I think we're meant to take these lifespans literally, that people really were living for centuries until something changes to stop that, which we're going to see in this passage. But the thing is that not everyone lives and dies in this passage, do they? That's one of the other things that actually jumps out at us. All right? There's this dude by the name of Enoch in the middle of this family line, and something different is going on with here. It says that when Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah, and after that he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God. 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived 365 years. Enoch walked with God, then he was no more, because God took him away. There's this interesting thing that happens when we read these early chapters of Genesis. When we read Genesis 4 first, and we see Cain and his descendants, and we think they're the bad guys, especially because Cain's great-great-grandson Lamech ends up, you know, sort of boasting about his sinfulness, and we saw that last week. And there's a tendency to look at Seth's line and say, well, this is the godly line, because they seem to know something of God, and there's no outright boasting of sin. But in this whole family line, Enoch is the only one who's actually described as walking with God. And he's the only one who actually says that he didn't actually experience the effect of that curse that God had put upon people in death. And so, what's actually going on here? But what's interesting is, it's even more singular than you think that it is. Alright? So if we chart all of the lifespans that we actually see here in these early chapters of Genesis, you start to realize something interesting, right? So I know it's hard to read, but these are the different guys: Adam, Seth, Enosh, Cain, Canaan. Well, they're spelled them differently, but same guys. And these are their lifespans, right? And you notice that Enoch here, with this shorter lifespan, is right in the middle. But what do you notice? You notice that Enoch's lifespan falls within the same timeline as everyone going all the way back to Adam and down to Lamech. So when we read this chapter, we tend to think, because we think family tree, we tend to think of one generation coming and then the birth of another and the other one dies. But because of these really long lifespans, Enoch isn't just described vertically singular in the sense of just out of his family tree. It's also a communal thing. Out of everybody who is living. So I've just done, this diagram just takes the same one, just turns it the other way. So we get the sense that these guys were all living and breathing and walking together at the same time. That Enoch, out of all of his family who was living at this point, he's the only one who it's said of that he walks with God. And he's the one that gets picked up on in the New Testament as well. We saw the same thing happen with Abel a couple of weeks ago, and the same thing happens here with Enoch. We're in Hebrews, we've got these heroes of faith being listed. The author says, by faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God, and without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists, and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. And so the author of the New Testament here makes this distinction of Enoch being the one who was saved And he, you know, it's described in the Genesis account as him walking with God, but it's described here in the New Testament as him having faith. In the same way that Abel was described as making the righteous, or as making the offering in the Genesis account, but he's described as doing it by faith in the New Testament account. And so he's the only one who walked with God and his family, but this is the really interesting thing again. He's not just one of ten, right, the ten people listed here in this account as far as the one that walked with God. Again, he's much more singular than that. Because if you start to do just some even basic conservative maths estimates of how many children would have been getting born and then having children themselves during these really, really long lifespans, when you've got somebody who's capable of having kids theoretically for hundreds and hundreds of years, I imagine that most of you, if I said to you how many people were living before the flood, you would have guessed in the tens of thousands kind of range. But if you even take a conservative estimate, you get to like 250 million pretty quick. And if you take a still reasonable but less conservative number as your starting point, you get to 4 billion pretty quickly. So Enoch isn't just one guy out of 10 in his family line that's described as walking with God. He's one guy out of possibly millions that is described as the only one who walks with God. And this fits with what we're going to see in the end of this reading, in Genesis 6:5 and onwards, where it talks about the state of everybody in the world at that point in time. And we're going to come back around to Enoch, but I want you to get that sense of just how singular it was for him to be described as the one who walks with God and who had faith in God here. One of the other things that jumps out a little bit is the fact that Noah gets a special mention. We're told about what Lamech, his dad, said before he was born, or as he was being born. He was named because he will comfort us in the labor and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed. I only mention Noah now to say that we're going to spend like 3 weeks looking at the whole flood narrative and all the sorts of stuff that's going on there. So we're not going to talk too much about Noah now, but just know it's a footnote that this is what's coming up. And now we get to a fun one, right? Who did this in growth group this week? And you're like, man, what? Nephilim? What is going on with these dudes? All right. So let me brace, guys. Okay, just shake it up for a sec. It's going to get a little technical. So just loosen up, just a little bit of that. Okay. All right. We're going to go deep here because it's a bit tricky. But it's okay, we're going to pull back at the end. So if you get lost along the way, that's okay. You can ask me questions later. But don't worry, we're going to pull back, and we're going to see what God is trying to do through it, because that's what the really important thing is. Alright, so. It says, when men began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. Okay. Begs the question, who are these sons of God? They seem to be different from regular guys. They're not the sons of men. They're the sons of God. What is that meant to be? Now, some commentators out there think that maybe it's just a reference to those that descended from Adam directly, except the problem with that is everyone descended from Adam. So, you know, why these guys singled out in particular. You've got some people think these are like kings of old and that sort of thing, but it's, you know, that's kind of trying to take other stories and figure out maybe if there's some overlap, what's going on here. The majority opinion, and the one that I really do think is right, is that these sons of God are in all likelihood some form of, you know, what we might call bad or fallen angels. Okay, spirits. And I'll show you some verses here so you know that we get this from the Bible itself. So, sons of God, right, is an interesting little phrase. We know the phrase son of God, alright, because that's a term that's actually given to the kings from the line of David later in the Old Testament. The son of God was a name that was given to him, but that's singular, son of God, and we also know that in the New Testament, of course, son of God becomes a title for Jesus also. Alright, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the sons of God. And this actually shows up in a couple of places in the Old Testament, although you wouldn't necessarily know it from just looking at our English translations. So for example, it says in Psalm 29, ascribe to the Lord, O mighty ones, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. That's the NIV. But if we go to the ESV, it says ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings. But if we actually just literally take the Hebrew and take those words and put it into English and don't try and convey anything more than that, it says, ascribe to the Lord, O sons of God. ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Alright, so the ESV is reading these things as probably spiritual beings. They don't seem to be humans in the context there. Alright, so what's going on? We think, well, maybe these are heavenly beings of some sort. And this is backed up by the fact that when we get to Job 1:6, in that famous passage where Satan comes before God, it says this: one day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" But that word that gets translated as angels, again, if we just take what the literal Hebrew translation is, it's one day the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. So there's this sense, particularly because it's a strong connection with Satan, and most of us take him to be a fallen angel and that sort of idea, that the sons of God here in Genesis are in all likelihood spiritual beings. Okay? So that means that what the story is relating to us is that we've got these spiritual beings who are looking at the daughters of men as they start to multiply, and these angels are like, "What are you doing?" Paraphrasing, alright? And it seems as though the daughters of men are like, "Oh, he's shiny, look at him. Gleaming in white and stuff. I like this boy." Alright? Because there's no sense in the text that these girls are being taken against their will. If anything, it's they had their choice. Okay, this was apparently a thing that the girls and their family wanted to go along with. But the question is, well, is that all that it is? Is it just, you know, boys liking pretty, you know, boys? Is it just angels liking pretty things and girls liking shiny things? I think there's more to it than that. So some of you might wonder, okay, well, how could these spiritual beings actually do this? Okay, aren't they spirit beings? Like, how does that actually work? But if we look at what angels do, we clearly see that angels have the ability to take on physical form and interact with the physical world. So, for example, at the resurrection, we see that there are the angels there, and they roll away the stone. That they're there present, that you can see them, that they interact with the physical world, that they sit where Jesus' body had laid. You know, they're actually, you know, just because they're angels doesn't mean that they can't do physical things. And some of you who are like real angel nerds are like, "Ah, but what about Matthew 22 where it says they won't be given in marriage and that we'll be like the angels who aren't given in marriage?" And it's like, well, just because they're not given in marriage doesn't mean that they can't do the physical act associated with it. So there is this possibility here. It all sort of makes sense that, yeah, you could have these spiritual beings hooking up with these daughters of men. And I think that, again, when we look at the context, and there's some more evidence that points it towards this at least fitting. Alright? So it says there in verse 3, "Then the Lord said, 'My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal, his days will be 120 years. This is that verse I was talking about where we have the clear change from these really long lifespans to a shorter, restricted one. But what's interesting is if you look even in your NIV Pew Bibles, you'll see a little footnote there down the bottom that says that word contend could also be translated as will not remain in. And I actually think it's the better idea. And if we take it as that, then let's think about what we've got. Because we've got to come up with a reason, right, for why these verses are here at the start of chapter 6. Like, why tell us this weird story about the sons of God and the daughters of men unless it fits with what's come before it and what's happening afterwards, right? So in Genesis 5, we've had these really long lifespans, but we have everyone keep dying. But then we have this description of some women being married to and taken by these spiritual beings, and the women are seemingly going along willingly with it. And God's response to this is to say, "My spirit will not remain in man forever, but he is mortal." He's saying, okay, man is dying. Man is flesh. Man will perish, and it is not proper for my spirit to remain in them and for them to keep living for centuries. They may have originally been designed for that, but that's not proper now. And God is saying this in response to these angelic human unions, which maybe the thought was that as death was coming for them, that they entered into these unions, because if you have a spiritual union of this type, that maybe long life or special abilities will be given to your children. And again, that seems to be what we get there, right, in verse 4. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were hearers of old, men of renown. It seems as though the product of the offspring of these angelic beings and these daughters of men were particularly special people and humans. And so maybe this is something akin to God looking at these unions and saying, I see what you're trying to do here, but you know what? Enough is enough. You're not going to live for that long. You're not going to be able to extend out your own lives, but rather, my spirit will not remain in you. 120 years will be the lifespan of people. And again, if we take this reading, and I know it's getting a little technical, some of you are just loving this, some of you are like, you're losing me, but it's okay, just stick with me. If we take this reading, then it makes sense of the fact that it says here the Nephilim were there in the days of Noah, in those days, and also afterwards. Right? Because think about this. We know from the flood narrative that we're going to see in a couple of weeks that the ones who survive in the flood are who? It's Noah and his family, right? But then we're getting told that the Nephilim were around then and would also be afterwards. So how is it possible that if nobody survived, okay, except for Noah's family, how could the Nephilim have been there before the flood and after the flood? Because we see them pop up in Numbers 13. When the Israelites on the edge of the promised land, they send the spies into the land, and they say, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there were of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. Okay? We saw these guys. And so how could they have been before the flood and after the flood? Well, my assumption is that these sons of God didn't stop going into the daughters of men and having kids with them. That this was something that continued happening on afterwards. For a while anyway. So there you go. That's the Nephilim. Now you know. It's all crystal clear. It's been brought to you in this perfect form. You can understand it well. Now, I joke, but honestly, I really do think that this is important for us to grasp on this big picture level. Right? Chapter 5. Long life after long life, but death, death, death. Start of chapter 6. Possible attempt by some daughters of men to extend their lives or to make something more special of it, which is partly successful, but God's response is to say, I'm not gonna have my spirit dwell in man forever and ever. That rather, I'm shortening the lifespan down because this is what needs to happen now in this world of sin and death. And then he goes on to say, oh, and by the way, it's bad everywhere. So the Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground, and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I've made them. Life and death, life and death, life and death. An attempt, maybe, to get around and defeat death. A declaration from God that death is now going to come very actively to all. That this is a universal problem. That everyone has been affected by this down to the level of every thought of their heart. That this is where sin has gotten to. And again, this is why it's all the more important to recognize just how singular Enoch's description is. That out of these millions, possibly billions of people made in the image of God, whose mission remained, they've become sinful on every level. And now only Enoch is described as the one who walks with God. But importantly, in the New Testament, what is Enoch's salvation ascribed to? It's his faith. It's not that he walked with God. It's not what he did. It's not his actions. What the New Testament says is that he is saved by his faith. And if Enoch is saved by his faith and not his actions, then we still are left with the sense that even Enoch, he was not the one righteous one that remained who could, you know, be saved according to his own strength, but rather one who still needed to trust into another. And of course, that's Jesus, right? That this through this massive amount of death that we see in these chapters, there is this thin tightrope that gets through it, and it looks at first glance as though Enoch is the one who's walked this tightrope, but it becomes clear from the New Testament that Enoch needed to have faith, that Enoch wasn't saved by his own works, and so the only one that it's saved by is Jesus. We have this hint pointing forwards towards Noah, which again I said we're going to look at in a few weeks. But even Noah is going to die. Enoch's the only one in this whole section here who doesn't taste death, and it's because he walked with God by faith. Jesus is the one who walks this tightrope for us. Everyone else dies. Everybody else fails. Everybody else falls. But Jesus has walked that tightrope of faith perfectly. He's the one that walked with God in such a way that he did everything that was required of us to do. He perfectly imaged God. He did everything that was required. He obeyed him in all things. And Jesus is the one that did what the billions before the flood and the billions since the flood have been completely unable to do. And the thing is that now, we're still called to walk with God, but what we need to understand is that this Christian walk that we're on now is not me now trying to, you know, walk this walk with God, because I fail. We fail. What it is recognizing that Jesus is that one sliver of hope, that where death lies on every side, that there is a way to life across the chasm, but while we all fail, Jesus has walked it perfectly, and when I have faith now, I don't walk that rope myself, but I join myself to him. The death may be on every side of me, but when I believe and trust in Jesus, I'm united to him, and now I follow in his footsteps, not by my strength, but by his. And I cling to salvation in him. That I walk with him, but I'm saved by my faith. And that's the thing, is that this is the walk that we're now on. Following Jesus along that tightrope. It's so narrow, and I'm so thankful that he's done it for me, but now I don't need to have fear. I mean, it's pretty crazy, right? We're walking on this tightrope, following Jesus' footsteps, trusting and holding onto him, and even though there's no safety net below us, we know that we're completely safe in the grace of Christ. And that even as I sin, I'm still forgiven because of what Jesus has done through his death on the cross. He shed his blood for us. He paid the price for our sins. He sorted that, and so now I cling to Jesus, and I follow him on that tightrope. Yes, I stumble. Yes, I fall, but as long as I cling to him, I'm not going down. And it's this funny thing I was thinking about it this week, right, is that death is just everywhere in this passage, especially when, like I said, you start to really try and do the maths and figure out just what's going on. It's there right in our face. But so often in our culture today, what we try to do is we try to push death aside. We don't want to think about death. We push any thought of it or any visual thing that goes along with it way out of our minds. I was saying to the guys at Amon, and this certainly applies to some of you guys here, that death is something that you've had to come to terms with, in the sense of, not that you're getting closer to it yourselves, I'm not trying to put that thought on there specifically, but more in the sense of your friends have died. People that you knew for years and years and years, people that you spent decades with are no longer here, and they weren't taken up, they went to the grave. And for us younger people, what we need to understand is, through passages like this, is that we can't be fooled into thinking that death is something that's not our problem. That death is something to avoid or deny or to sort of push away and all that sort of stuff, but to realize that outside of the tightrope that Christ has walked for us, death is an ever-present reality all around us. And what Jesus actually does is that he defeats death, absolutely, but he also reclaims death as the metaphor for how we're actually to live our lives. That we're actually to live our lives by putting ourselves to death. So it says in Luke 9:23, then he said to them all, whoever wants to be my disciple, whoever wants to follow me, must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit their very self? See, as Jesus has walked the tightrope, what we need to do is let those other things that aren't on that tightrope, that aren't what Jesus wants us to do, we need to let them fall and die.
We need to walk with God and let go of and put to death those things that are not of Him. That we need to recognize that the narrow path to salvation is something that only He has done, but now as we seek to follow Him, we're on a narrow path as well. That there's all sorts of things in the world that we say no to. And I'm not talking about being a monk and moving away and just, you know, avoiding it in that sense. I mean in recognizing that as we do things in this world, that there is a narrow way that we're to follow and to do good and to follow Jesus in that, and that that's what we're called to do, to walk with God, to put to death this mortal flesh. Because the promise is that now as God's Spirit dwells in us, that and time is coming when we're going to be given new flesh and new life, but while we live in this mortal flesh, we die to it again and again and embrace the walk with God that He has for us. So we're going to pray now for that. I'm going to give us a moment here, just quietly, to think on those things that we know God doesn't want us to walk with. To think on those things that we need to let go. To think on those things that God wants us to put to death. To bring them before Him. And then we'll pray for God's Spirit to lead us and guide us in walking this walk with Him. Let's do that now. Father, as Your Spirit brings before us now those things that we know are not of You. Those things that are of our mortal flesh. Please, Lord, lead us and guide us in letting them go. To put them to death, and instead to walk with You. That we would pick up our cross and die to our mortal selves, in order that we might live in accordance with Your Spirit. That, Father, all of us here who would trust in You, would cling to You, that we'd be willing to walk the tightrope, knowing that we cannot fall, knowing that while we may stumble, we are completely and safely tethered to You in Your grace and mercy to us in Jesus. Pray, Father, for those here who aren't trusting in You. We pray, Lord, that You might work in their spirits and their hearts, and that they would cling to You, that they would recognize that the narrow path is not something they can walk themselves, but, Lord, one that only You can walk, and that they might lay hold of the grace and mercy that You have for us. And we pray, Father, that as we walk this walk together, that we would love and encourage one another, that we would build one another up, that we identify and encourage the walk that we have that Jesus has laid before us, and that we reach the end well together. And we thank You for this in Jesus' name. Amen.